we see already what guys who are neither working nor looking for work do with their time. It's not a heartening picture. I don't think we should want to be buying more of that through public policy.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. A lot of focus is put on the employment rate by today's economists, and by their measure, the jobs market is still robust, with unemployment currently at 3.7%, down near all-time lows. However, those calculations completely ignore the 100 million U.S. adults categorized as not in the labor force, who do not work and are not looking for work. That's pretty much one out of every three U.S. adults. A good number of those people are retired or are students. Some are caregivers and some are on disability, but a growing number of them, especially men between 25 and 54 years old, are voluntarily giving up finding work. It's gotten to the point where one in six prime working age men has no paid work at all. Economist Nicholas Eberstadt calls the rise of this non-working class and the associated despair that comes with it America's invisible crisis. Nicholas is the Henry Wendt Chair in Political Economy at the American Enterprise Institute and author of the book Men Without Work. We're fortunate to speak with him today about the implications of our deteriorating labor force and the most needed reforms to address it. Nicholas, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a blast.
Well, thanks. Extremely timely topic, as we were talking about before we turned the camera on. I've already been sort of teeing this topic up in a couple previous videos and on Twitter. And to have an expert like you who's really been steeped in the data here to really kind of peel the curtain back for us is going to be really helpful. To kick things off here, just a very high level question for you, Nicholas. What's your current assessment of the U.S. labor market?
We've got a bizarre situation in this post-pandemic economy where we have a unprecedented peacetime labor shortage, as you know, with still over 10 million, almost 11 million slots unfilled. The number of unfilled positions in the United States has jumped by about 4 million since before the pandemic. And by a strange mirroring process, the number of people in the workforce is about 4 million fewer than we would have expected on pre-COVID trends. My book on Men Without Work looks at the flight from work by these prime age men, the 25 to 54 year olds that you mentioned. But the new face of the flight from work is people over 55 who were a ray of sunshine in the pre-pandemic dismal tableau of employment for the United States, and also prime age women.
Okay, all right, prime age women too. I'm gonna get to them as well, because we're gonna talk a lot initially about men, but I'm curious if we're seeing a similar trend amongst women. So I want to put some numbers to the situation. Real quick, though, you talked about how open jobs have jumped by about 4 million since the pandemic, and we've seen somewhat of a mirroring loss of people in the workforce. What has caused those jobs to jump? Have we literally just, has the economy been so strong that it's 4 million jobs more than it was pre-pandemic, or is something else going on there?
Well, I was taught economics shortly after the end of the Stone Age, but back then they told us that the lump of labor fallacy was a fallacy, that it is not correct that the good Lord sprinkled a certain limited number of hours of work on each continent. What we see with this mirroring that I mentioned to you is kind of like an incarnation of the lump of labor fallacy. You have a 5 million deficit and a 4 million deficit and a 4 million surplus. It's not supposed to work that way in market economies. And the miracle of the market is the miracle of the market, but it does not affect, it does not cure pathologies, let's say. A part of what we have seen going on since the outbreak of the COVID tragedy is the unintended consequence of massive government interventions. Any government intervention has unintended consequences. Massive interventions have massive unintended consequences. In the quest to rescue the pandemic economy during lockdown from a repeat of the Great Depression or a global collapse, which obviously we avoided, our policymakers overshot. And the years 2020 and 2021 are, I think, the only time in recorded history when disposable income for a population in the middle of a national economic crisis actually increased.
Went up, yeah.
That was due, obviously, to public funds used as transfer payments. But we were sloshing with so much transfer money that the public couldn't actually even spend it. So our savings rate in 2020 and 2021 doubled. It's gone back down now, of course. Yeah. But during that period, the public put together a nest egg, an addition, a transfer payment nest egg of over $2.5 trillion. And that's one of the wealth effects that I think we're seeing in play here. You know, a lot of people use that wealth to supplement their earnings. Some people used it to substitute for their earnings. And I think it helps to explain why more people are out of the labor force today than we would have anticipated before COVID.
Got it. Yeah, we gave them a lot of money. There are a lot of different ways. And a number of those people decided to step off the working hamster wheel, either or through early retirement or just, hey, I got enough. I don't have to work right now. Right. Again, I want to really peel into that. And this was a problem before the pandemic came along in terms of this checking out of men, too. The pandemic, I believe, just exacerbated this. You're nodding as I'm saying this, correct?
Sure. Absolutely.
All right. Great. So let me just get to the data here then. So how many active workers are there in the economy today?
Let's see. There'd be 100 and it's I would say 154 million, is that right? I'll have to look it up and tell you the exact number.
That's okay. I'm looking for broad brushes here. Yeah. Okay, so about
100. It's north of 150 million.
Okay, great. Now, when we talk about, you know, the unemployment rate, how many people make up the unemployed ballpark about today?
That's an interesting question. All in all, we'd have north of 5-6. About 5 million, I guess.
About 5 million. Okay. And you know where I'm going with this, right?
Which
you know, we're basically saying, so that 5 million is the numerator, right?
Yeah.
What that numerator ignores is the figure that I mentioned in my introduction here, right? Which is that there are now 100 million people, 16 years or older in America, who are not counted in that unemployment calculation here. They are deemed as being outside the labor force, right? Sort of almost the government just sort of ignores them, says they're not going to be employable.
Right. Yeah. Well, so remember that our unemployment and employment statistics, the monthly jobs report that our policymakers and our financial markets depend upon for information. This is a statistical system that was put together to fight the last war. It was put together at the end of the Great Depression to measure conditions in the Great Depression. And back in the very early 1940s, right before World War II, the idea that a man, and back then paid work was almost all male. The idea that a man who didn't have a job wouldn't be looking for one, especially if they were of prime working age, was dumbfounding. No, nobody would have thought of that. Fast forward to our convo today, and now we have a situation in 2022 where for every prime age man who does not have a job and is looking for a job, the classic definition of unemployment. There are over four guys who are neither working nor looking for work. So if you use the unemployment rate to measure the condition of the labor market, in particular for prime age guys, you are missing four-fifths of the problem today.
Yeah, that is amazing to me. So first off, let's talk about these 100 million people and how they got on that list of, hey, we're not even assuming they're ever going to work. Now, some of them are too old to work, right? Some of them are the old. Some of them, because that number starts at 16 years old. Some of them are still in school, right? They're high school students or college students or grad students, and that's where they should be. Now, some of them are caregivers, right? Some of them are stay-at-home parents, right? Some of them are on disability. Some are in the military. So again, broad brush, add those folks up and then remove them from the 100 million total. Sure. What's left over?
All right. Well, so what we're an aging society, like all other affluent Western populations. And so we have an increasing share of our population that's, let's say, over pensionable age, say over 65. We have a certain number of prime age women who are not in the economy for various reasons. The traditional reason was because you were at home being a homemaker. You were working, but you weren't getting paid for it. You had a lot of work, but you weren't getting paid for it. And then, as you say, increasingly for those who are under 25, there's graduate school, college, a lot of high school. Our modern economy requires more training than the economy did in 1940 when our economic statistics on employment were being developed. Back then, they looked at people from the age 14 on, you know, so.
And they could hand you a shovel and you could get started on a job.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the group that I'm most concerned about are the, in this book of mine, Men Without Work, in this post-pandemic edition, the ones I'm most concerned with here are the 63, let's say, million guys who are, and we'll get into the nerdy talk here, they are civilian, non-institutional men. And by that mean you're not in the military, you're not in prison or a insane asylum or whatever institution would be, men who are of what we would say is kind of like prime working age. Now, of those 63, about over 7 million of them are neither working nor looking for work in the latest monthly job report. If we dig in a little bit deeper, we'll see that a fraction of them are full-time students. So they're temporarily out of the workforce because they want to get back in the game with, you know, better skills and the possibility of higher pay. But almost 90%, over 6 million of these guys are neither employed nor in education or training. And this group, I think, is the group that is most troubling and most concerning. And it's a vastly larger group than it was two generations ago, not just in absolute terms, but as a share of young male potential working power.
Okay, so you just answered my next question, was is this unprecedented? And it sounds like the answer is yes. So something here is causing able-bodied, prime age men in particular, this sector that we're talking about here, to basically just kind of give up, to check out, to tune out, and All right, let's dig into that. And I know there are a couple other factors. You mentioned sort of a bigger number of 63 million men that are civilian, non-institutional, prime working age. I'd love to understand, you know, what's keeping some of those guys out of the workforce. I know that incarceration is a big issue, and we're going to talk about that at some point. But let's talk about these 6-ish million folks that really should be working. Let's put it that way, from a societal standpoint. You know, there's no good societal reason why those folks shouldn't feel inspired, desirous, and able to get a job, and yet they are just clocking out, right? So what are the factors that are leading to this?
Well, so one of the factors that I think we can dismiss is the argument that there isn't work out there. When I came out with my first edition of this Men Without Work book back in 2016, one of the critiques that I got in some reviews was more or less of kind of like a more polite version of Eberstadt, you moron, you don't understand that there aren't any jobs out there. You could maybe try to make that argument in 2016, although I think that wasn't a great argument back then. In the face of the peacetime labor shortage we see now, that's a laughable argument. If you ask the men who are not in the workforce for a year or more, we do this in our, you know, in our Bureau of Labor Statistics surveys once a year. You know, what is the reason that you're not in the workforce? A tiny fraction. Well, I mean, now I don't know. It's like around 5%. It's usually around 10%. Say that it's because there's no work to be had. So it's for, they say it is for other reasons. One of the reasons that we know it's not because so many guys are at home taking care of the kids. I mean, there are a lot of women who are at home taking care of the kids and give that as a reason that they're out of the workforce. But there's like a care chasm between guys and girls, even still to this day. And so it's an order of magnitude larger for women than it is for prime age men. So it's got to be, it's not for staying home taking care of people. It's not because there isn't any work. It's for other reasons. Now, these surveys are kind of Procrustean. You've got 7 million people and you've got like 7 different categories that you can put yourself in. So it's pretty, you know, it's a pretty blunt instrument. But I think we can eliminate some of the possibilities pretty directly.
Okay, so a couple of things. First off, you know, you mentioned that you wrote your initial version of your book, Man Without Work, in 2016. So this problem that we're talking about predates all the distortions that COVID created. So we can put COVID aside as like, well, COVID is what caused this. No, it just exacerbated it. All right, so you gave us some things that they are not doing. So, these aren't the reasons why they ejected from the workforce. Having read a little bit of your work so far, you know, it sounds like this really is a, I would say, a rejection of a desire to work, but it really is more of like a dejection, right? Where these men feel that the system has sort of failed to provide them with the type of employment that they want or the type of experience they want. And I'm going to make a comment that is an unfairly broad brush, but kind of reading some of your work, it sounds like a lot of these guys are just sitting on the couch playing video games and kind of mooching off their parents, girlfriends, or spouses, right? And that's it's a cruel way to say it. I'm sure it's not that way in every case. But the point is they're not giving up paid work for some other higher form of fulfillment or productivity. They are really downshifting their contribution to society here.
Adam, for thousands of generations, men 25 to 54 years of age have been our society's providers. It's our natural providers. And to be cast in the role of sort of permanent dependent in those ages for those men is not only kind of unnatural, but I think it's really disheartening. We can learn a lot by what these guys say they do with their time. In the time use surveys that the Labor Department collects every year to figure out, you know, what time adults are working, other things. According to the not in labor force men that we're discussing, in their own responses to these surveys, they basically say they don't do civil society. There's almost no worship or volunteering or charitable activity. They've got a lot of time on their hands, but they don't do a whole lot of help around the house, either with household chores or with people at home. What they say they're doing is watching. They say they're watching screens, and the surveys won't tell us what they're watching or what type of screens. But at like 2,000 hours a year, I mean, like a fairly full-time job, this is their vocation. And to make the picture look even more dispiriting, one of these surveys before the pandemic asked people, "Are you taking pain medication?" And the men without work that we're talking about, almost half of them said, "Yeah, I'm taking pain medication every day." So it's not just playing, Call of Duty. It's playing Call of Duty stoned. And that's not a great way to build the skills to get back into the workforce, but it may be unfortunately a way to kind of make yourself a candidate for deaths of despair.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, so first off, I just want to make clear too, to folks watching this, we're not trying to beat up on those who are out of work here. Quite the contrary. And I understand how difficult it can be when you've lost a job to have to go through the process of hearing no a lot before you find the next job opportunity here. Again, what Nicholas is talking about here is the category of guys who aren't even doing that part, right? Where they have, for one reason or another, given up, gotten too dispirited, and have just said, I'm done with work, right? And this is what I'm going to do with my time now. So, Nicholas, we're talking about an unprecedented percentage, an absolute number, millions and millions of able-bodied men in this particular case here, who are retrograding, we'll call it, at least sort of from a societal contribution standpoint. Yes, I can imagine that could be totally corrosive to their sense of self-worth and their enjoyment of life. I imagine the medicated question that you asked, I'm not sure if it asked about what other types of substances they might be using, but I'm sure there's probably, some additional substance use going on, just again, to kind of get through the day emotionally. You're nodding as I'm saying this. Feel free to make any comments that you like, but the question I want to get to is so a very high individual cost for these people from just sort of a quality of life standpoint to be at this stage, but from a societal cost, what are your concerns about the short and long-term costs that this is extracting on society to have this many of what should be kind of your best contributors not in the game? And maybe you can answer this too, maybe not ever back in the game.
So we, in addition to having, somewhat problematic employment statistics following the labor market for reasons we've already mentioned, we also have a statistical situation where our disability insurance programs in the nation are a kind of a jumbled crazy quilt of programs that don't talk to each other. So there's nobody in Washington or anywhere else who can tell you how many unique individuals are obtaining one or more disability benefit each month. I tried to make some sense of this in the book. I think I can show that over half of these workless men are obtaining at least one benefit, and about two-thirds of them live in homes that are obtaining at least one of these benefits. We get into something which is kind of devilishly difficult here, Adam, because if you're on disability, you're not supposed to be able to work, right? It's about there's some problem that is, there is some reason, some health reason that you're not able to work. And this gets us into a very gray area, because over the past generation and a half, the two categories that have risen most rapidly as reasons for eligibility to disability benefits are what's called musculoskeletal problems and psychological difficulties. Now, if you or I go to a doctor, they can tell us whether we got a broken leg. If you or I go to a doctor, they can tell us whether we have COVID. If you or I go to a doctor, they cannot tell whether we have back pain or not, whether, you know, if we claim we have back pain. And a doctor cannot tell whether I had sad feelings or not. So we have this big gray area. There's a lot of pain there. How much of that pain is psychosocial and how much of it is physical is something that, you know, is beyond my pay grade. As to the question of the individual and social consequences of this trend, there really aren't any good ones. I mean, you could make the supposition that being out of the workforce is leisure. I mean, when I was trained in economics way back when, there was this kind of verbal tick, and we were taught that people had either work or leisure. But leisure is actually a very particular use of your free time. It's either restorative or enlightening. I was just telling you from these time use surveys, we see an awful lot of time use that's kind of degrading, self-degrading. I think what we're seeing here is a terrible waste of human potential that does lead to an enormous amount of personal misery. But if we look at the social consequences, you know, just tick down the list, slower economic growth, bigger income and wealth gaps, more dependence on social programs, probably more public debt, more pressure on fragile families, less social mobility, less contact with civil society, less trust in our public institutions. I mean, there's just nothing good that comes out of this.
Yeah, and I imagine that it becomes a hole that gets harder and harder to get out of the longer that you're in it, correct?
And you were talking earlier about being out of work and getting back into work. For people who are unemployed in the U.S., the picture on mobility back and forth into employment is pretty good. I mean, apart from a couple of, you know, kind of disaster episodes, like right after the financial panic of 2008, or in the first months of COVID, usually the mean time out of a job is measured in weeks. It's a very different thing for people, for guys in particular, who drop out of the workforce. They are most likely to become long-termers. The mobility between the not in labor force group and the employed population is very, very, very small for men. It's not quite the same way for women. And this is kind of interesting because we've got this existence proof in post-war America that people can be out of the labor force for a long period of time, for years and years, and get back in quite successful. They're called women, and they're more specifically called mothers. But think of what skills a mother has to have to be a mom. You don't get sick days. You don't get to call a vacation when you want. You have to be reliable, ready, timely. And all of these are skills, no matter what the educational attainment level, that employers appreciate.
Right. That's a great way to think about it. Yeah. I mean, you're the home run, the homemaker and the caregiver. I mean, you're the head of ops. Usually the head of the chief financial officer managing the expenses, right? You have to be in customer service. I mean, there's just all sorts of things that you have to do. all right, look, you brought up a bunch of questions. I want to try to hammer through them before we get to, I'd like to sort of end this discussion on the type of reforms that you think we should prioritize as a nation to try to reverse some of this societal increasingly drag that we're experiencing here from all this. Let's see. Some of these are going to be not entirely linearly connected. Mm-hmm. You mentioned disability for a moment back there. Yep. There has been, for a good while now, I think kind of even coming out of 2008, there have been those that have claimed that there's been there has been a sharp uptick in the number of people getting on disability. And some have said, well, that's just due because we are to the fact that we are basically better at acknowledging the wide spectrum of types of things that could disable somebody, mental health being a big one. But there's been others that have said, no, people are gaming the system. And there certainly have been studies that I've heard where, they've looked at certain counties and realized that, like, 90% of all the scripts that get somebody on disability are being issued by just a couple of doctors. So there's almost this sort of pay for a disability stamp. How much abuse, if any, do you think is going on? Like, how much of this problem of people being out permanently out of the workforce is because of people gaming the system through disability? Is it a big problem or a small problem?
I don't think we can know precisely how big a problem it is because, to its discredit, the many disability programs that I've mentioned, the Social Security Administration's programs, the Veterans Administration's programs, the state disability programs, they haven't done a due diligence analysis of this question. They haven't examined this the way that an inspector general ought to examine an important question like this, to have medical checkups. So we have to kind of surmise. My guess, and I have to say it's only a guess, is that if we had a reform of disability programs, the way we had a welfare reform that was focused upon single mothers in the 1990s, that millions of these men would return to work. But that's just a guess, and I can't prove it.
Okay, but it sounds like you suspect, you intuit that it is a material factor, maybe not the driving one, but it's a material factor to the issue.
Well, compare and contrast. Back in 1965, when our society was poorer than it is today, less healthy than it is today, less educated than it is today, the proportion of guys not in the workforce was a third as high as it is today. So what has changed? Are there really, can that all be explained, or can most of that be explained by new form, by diagnosing previously undiagnosed illness? That's hard for me to wrap my head around. I can imagine there's a scope for some of that. I mean, mainly when I look at the differences, I think about this. Back in 65, almost all prime age guys were married, and most of them had children under the same roof as them. There's a provider impulse there that many men don't have these days. Almost all of the guys in 65 had served in the military, and a lot of them had served in World War II or in the Korean War. The situation is obviously very different today. Back in 65, the Great Society, our current American welfare state, was still just mainly a dream in Lyndon Johnson's eye. It hadn't rolled out yet. And back in 65, if you were playing around with drugs, you got in a lot of trouble. You really got in a lot of trouble back then. So there's also a huge change in norms that I cannot quantify for you, but I'd be doing a disservice if I said just because I can't quantify this for you, I can't be mentioned.
Okay, yeah, and I, given the fact that this is a topic that you have researched for years, I think your intuition is, I place a lot more weight on it than the average person like myself who's just opining on the internet, right? So you mentioned some really interesting factors there. So obviously, there's the provider issue where most men had family. There's the fact that guys had been in the military. So A, they had a lot of training, right? They had marketable skills they could put to use. And also they had a sense of soldiering through adversity, right? Where we don't have that. Also, as you said, it was much more punitive if you got caught with drugs. We have a much more drug permissive society today. We have a lot of folks that have zero, you know, military training. And a number of things I want to tick through here, but I'm going to jump to this one. How much of this is sort of the snowflake society issue, where, you know, I'm painting with a very broad brush here, but I think we have become a more coddled society as the generations have gone on. Certainly the millennial generation has a stereotypical, you know, criticism of it, of being the everybody got a medal, everybody's a snowflake, they can't stand microaggressions and whatnot. Not saying that that's accurate, mm-hmm. just saying that that's the stereotype. Mm-hmm. But does that come into play here at all, where these folks are just saying like, hey, you know, I tried the job, but they gave me a broom and made me do some work at the bottom rung that I didn't want to do, and it kind of sucked, and I didn't get promoted as fast as I wanted, so I'm taking my ball and I'm going home. I'm just not going to play anymore.
So I'm a nerd who works, on a computer in my basement, right? And so I'm looking at things which have, you know, decimal points on them. You're talking about a very inescapably human quality here. Mm-hmm. What we're missing at the moment is the natural complement to my work, which would be active and curious reporters, anthropologists, narrators who go into communities and talk with real live human beings about what they're feeling and what they're doing. If our press corps were worth its weight, we'd have people in hundreds of communities doing that right now. I mean, one of the few compelling narratives, I hate that word, but let's use it, on this situation was Senator-elect J.D. Vance's book, Hillbilly Elegy. And he talked in a very loving and, I think, non-judgmental way about all the people he knew in his life in Appalachia who were gaming the system, or got kind of like got peeved that they were criticized at work and dropped out of it. Of course, that was a particularly distressed community. Now, I can tell you that in my own homework, one of the things that I have noticed, and I don't think this is a good thing for our country, is the death of the summer job for teenagers. Okay. Now, back near the beginning of time, when I was a young'un, summer work was a thing for guys and girls who were teens. And it was great because you made some pocket money. You could put it aside for school. You're independent from your parents. You could do things that you want to on your own, right? From the 70s, when we started to collect these numbers, through the Census Bureau to today, we've seen the proportion of 15 to 17 year olds in July who are looking for a job or had a job drop from over 60% to well under 30%, down towards 25%.
Wow.
And so it means that everybody who's like kind of like well off is in some sort of enrichment. And, if you're not, maybe you're doing remedial, but you're not making money and you're not learning about what the work world is like. So the collision between you and, you know, job realities is now increasingly being postponed into 20s or mid-20s for young men and women. And that's not a good thing. I mean, you can have your attitude adjustment when you're 15, 16, or 17, and it's going to be a whole lot more effective, I think, than if you postpone that for a decade.
Yeah, I really hope that... that these social scientists that you mentioned do get involved to really dig into, you know, the complementary side of your work to really flesh out what's going on here. My wife is a therapist, and we have conversations all the time about how we as a society have been sort of delaying adolescence or extending adolescence through the 20s, right? And that there's a lot that's not good about that. But that's not our purview here. You are getting into the next topic I wanted to get into. Real quick before I bring it up, I just want to clarify here.
Yep.
Is this mostly because of an attempt to delay adolescence, or either you know, I want my kid to be in an enriched program, or I just want them to have a fun summer and not have to, you know, slave like I did as a kid, you know, hawking burgers when I was 16. Or is it more, and then this is the question I want to get into, is one of the other concerns that many, including myself, have raised is that we have provided a tremendous incentive over the past decade plus to replace human labor wherever possible with automation or outsourcing in this country. We've been making it increasingly expensive to employ a human in the US, and we have made credit until very recently so cheap while we've been putting a lot of capital investment in automation, robotics, AI, et cetera, plus the whole outsourcing movement, where there's just been a massive, what I would call malincentive for employers to say, man, if I can get rid of the human part of this job and replace it with technology or somebody, you know, for a fraction of the cost in a different country, man, I'm going to do that. And certainly with automation, once those jobs are gone, they're gone for good. They don't come back. You don't reshore an automated job. So it does seem like, you know, we've all seen the stories of the kiosks coming into the McDonald's and stuff like that. I mean, there's all sorts of examples we could point to of what used to be an entry level job that's now gone, right? So we're removing the lower rungs of the ladder towards mm-hmm. gainful employment. How much that's a problem here?
Well, I can't tell you whether this time is different or not. There are arguments both ways that this is just the continuation of the labor saving that we've seen lift us out of absolute poverty into affluence, or that this is going to be the great disruption. And I don't have an intelligent opinion about which way we're actually going at this point. Whichever argument is correct, they're both strong arguments for increasing the skills of our population and our young people. At the moment, with this, with this strange, unnatural labor shortage in our country, and employers basically begging for job applicants, teen or otherwise, I don't think at the moment we can be confident that the reason that there isn't work for teens is because it's been outsourced and robotized. I would say there is a there's a big cautionary in the time use numbers that I adduced for you about looking at universal basic income as a way of dealing with mass automation. I mean, you know, we see already what guys who are neither working nor looking for work do with their time. It's not a heartening picture. I don't think we should want to be buying more of that through public policy.
That is a great point. That is a great point on the UBI argument, which is because these guys, and I sort of made note of this earlier, but you can clarify, because people have asked me as I've been preparing for this interview, there are that many of those guys, how are they like funding their lifestyle? And, you know, if they're not on disability, it's pretty much, from what I could tell from your research, is they're living with their parents, they're living with a girlfriend, they're living with a spouse, they're living off of somebody else's income stream. So, you know, we're seeing that, okay, if you get a free income stream provided, what do you use with your time? And you're saying, well, they're not working on curing cancer.
Well, it's not a pretty picture. They're not living like princes. There is doubtless some moonlighting there, Adam, but it's not the people are, you know, getting second homes with the hidden income that they're generating. It's a dependent condition, and it's fairly penurious. That being said, the men without work, from what I could research in my studies, are not the poorest segment of our society. If we look at kind of like spending patterns, which I think are a much better proxy for living standards than reported income, if we look at spending patterns, the bottom fifth in our society is disproportionately single moms. They have a really hard time.
Yeah.
The The men without work fall in the stratum above that, like maybe the second quintile, the 20 to 40% group. It's ironic, but that's kind of like what we used to think of as the working class. This is like the unworking class.
Yeah, the unworking class. You know, on that vein, so I just want to mention some stats here. So in 1950, the number of workers per Social Security retiree was 16 to 1, right? It was actually even a lot higher in the 40s, but that's because this program was just starting and a lot of folks hadn't retired yet and they didn't live as long. It's now down to 2.7, if I believe correctly. That's the latest data I found. So, you know what, that's like a... not quite an eight times decrease, but it's you know, there's a lot more weight on the shoulder of today's workers, right? And that a lot of that has to do with demographics, right? But you know, when you think of the weight that's on today's workers, and then you realize that people who could and perhaps should be working alongside the productive workers who are working are checking out, that's even more of that weight on their shoulders going forward. By 2035, which is, you know, a little over a decade from now, it's going to be down just to 2 to 1, right? So that will have been a full, you know, seventh, eighth, whatever, decrease from the 50s.
Yep.
So, I mean, how much does this worry you that we are basically hollowing out the foundational pillar that supports the entire system here?
Well, the demographics of a Ponzi scheme, you know, is kind of problematic. And I don't think I'm going to tell you anything that you haven't thought of yourself or that other people haven't written about. There has to be a transition to self-financing retirement. There's going to be an unlucky cohort in the transition from the pay-as-you-go to the self-financing one. And there's kind of not a good way of sugarcoating that, because it's hard to figure out how you you know, end up with the kind of Pareto optimal all winners, no losers in that one. That being said, of course we'd be better off with more people, you know, live longer, work longer, and more people who are capable of working, contributing economically. I would make this not so much a dollars and cents argument, because there's so much benefit that is non-pecuniary in work and in taking on the vocation of work.
Right.
I mean, work is a service to others that helps complete you. We go way back, and that funny little Greek guy, Aristotle, you know, talked about how human beings are social creatures. We are social creatures. We need to be connected to society or we suffer. And if you're not connected by family, if you're not connected by work, if you're not connected by your community, if you're not connected by your religious faith, you're kind of like unhinged and untethered. And good things don't happen that way. So there's a, you know, the argument for being in the workforce, if you can, I think wins on its own merits. They're non-pecuniary merits, but the pecuniary is an added benefit there.
Right, right. And I sort of think of it as the individual versus the society, right? You just gave a lot of the individual benefits as a society, and that's why I was sort of looking at those Social Security numbers.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you're looking at that and you're saying, wow, we're losing this war if I have to put my resources to effective use. But just to make it really clear, I actually found my way to your work through Mike Rowe, who you know, today's...
What a prince he is.
And a sage for the personal benefits of work. So I'm 1,000% on the...
He's such a champ. God bless the work he does. He's a prince.
There was one stat, and this is straight from the Social Security program's website, ssa.gov. This blew my mind, and I don't want to rat hole on this, but I just love to get your opinion on it. It says And talking about disability, about 1 in 4 of today's 20-year-olds will become disabled before reaching age 67. That blew my mind. Is that really accurate?
Well, again, it depends what you mean by disabled. By disabled, do you mean someone who becomes a beneficiary of the disability program, or do you mean somebody who is disabled? I think they mean somebody who becomes a beneficiary of the disability program.
Exactly. I believe that's why they have it here too. But 1 in 4.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, on the face of it, it sounds to me as if this is a good reason for an inspector general. I mean, we do have a lot of health problems in our country. We've had the deaths of despair problem. We've had a slowdown and stagnation in life expectancy improvements. So it's not as if nothing bad is going on there. But I think we can be mindful of health problems in America and also mindful of where is the inspector general, please.
Yeah, agreed. If we are indeed taking 1 out of every 4 people out of the workforce on disability between 20 and 67, something's going really wrong, because we don't have the, if this were 18, 23, and people were getting run over by, stagecoaches and getting cholera and stuff, I'd get it, right? But we're in the modern era here. If you're all right, let's go. We may go a little bit over the hour here, because sure. I still have a couple of key questions before we get to your recommended reforms. One of which is, I am sure one of the things that the pandemic response did, because we pumped so much stimulus into the system, is it gave people the ability to get out of the workforce, right? They were getting checks in the mail. There was eviction protection. There's still student loan repayment protection. There's all sorts of things. There were increased child care tax credits, all sorts of stuff like that, that pumped a lot of excess money into the system. There's been a hot debate on how much of that pig is still left in the python. I just finally saw a chart of it last week, actually, that I'll try to put up again here. It shows that there's maybe still a little over $1 trillion that's still making its way out, but it looks like it'll be out. It'll be used up by about mid-2023.
That sounds right to me. That sounds right.
Okay. That allowed some existing workers to eject, but it led to the Great Resignation. Which was, yes, some people quitting their job and saying, I'm just going to take my luck at home for a while. But it also led to a whole bunch of people retiring, right? Because up until the end of last year, asset prices were on a mad tear and they were at record highs, right? Sure. How much of the issue we're talking about in this 25 to 54 range is people who retired early?
It looks much more as if it's people over 55 who were retiring early, I would say prematurely, and I'd also suspect unsustainably. As the wealth effects subside, you mentioned, the asset prices as well, though they're well down, obviously. There were a considerable number of people over 55 who had rather small net worth of under $25,000, as best the Census Bureau measures this, who may have been part of this population that exited the labor force. One of the things that we, I think, failed at pretty badly as a country or a society in our post-Cold War era was including the bottom half of America in this wealth updraft that we've enjoyed in our country. On the eve of the COVID pandemic, the real net worth of the bottom half of American households per household was no higher than it was when the Berlin Wall came down. And if you think about what else happened with assets in America over that period, that's pretty stunning. Which is to say that there were a lot of people who for whom the COVID windfall was a great big deal, doubling their net worth. And an extra $25,000 may not seem like a way of kind of like building a long-term retirement, but it may be enough to keep people out of the workforce, as you were saying, for a year or so.
Okay. Again, provided there's no other massive liquidity injection, in the next 6 months, it looks like that will have dissipated through the system. And of course, TBD, what's going to happen with the stock markets? They've had a rough year this year, but if we continue to go into recession and the bear market continues next year, as I've been saying for a while, it sounds like you sort of have similar thoughts, is the great resignation may remorph into the great unretirement party or the great please may I have my job back party. And you're nodding. All right. Well, look, I wanted to give you a chance just to comment on two quick things. I'm sure we could spend a lot of time on both of them, but then we'll get to the reforms and close things up. So first off, any other things about women that you'd like to say that we haven't touched upon yet? I mean, are we seeing, you said they're much better off relatively, but are we seeing any material part of the female population do a similar checkout like this?
Oh, I'm glad you asked that. Yes. I would not do the red flashing light thing, but I would say yellow cautionary lights. This is something that bears watching. In particular, there is a one demographic group that I think merits concern. These are the prime age women who have no children at home, are not in the labor force, neither employed in education or training, and are not currently married. And this group is not as big as the checked out prime age men that I mentioned, but it has been growing exponentially for the last couple of decades, and it is now over 3 million, which is not a small number. It's smaller than 7 million, but 3 million isn't chump change either. If you look at the time use patterns that these women describe, that they self-report, they're not as extreme as for the men who are neither in employment, education, or training, but they're getting a little too close for comfort. And in addition, in the COVID period, I think it was in 2021, the Census Bureau asked that question about pain pill use or about pain medication, I should say. Almost half of those women in this group I'm describing also said they were using pain medication every day. And so this is a form of gender equality that we shouldn't want.
Yeah, totally agree. Not one that we want to aspire to. All right. Nicholas, I'm just going to have to be back on at some point to really dig into some of these things that I'm hitting you unfairly here at the last moment with. So in your work too, you have talked about incarceration
Yes.
as a big issue here.
Yes.
So maybe we get back up to that sort of 63 million
Sure.
civilian non-institutional men. Yeah, they might be non-institutional, but some of them may be incarcerated. But you basically said that, well, I don't want to put words in your mouth. So why don't you tell us how big an
Sure.
issue is increased criminalization had on worsening this problem?
I think it has had a major impact. And along with the statistical flaws I mentioned about employment statistics, about disability coverage, one of the huge gaps in our national social and demographic statistical system concerns people who have felonies in their background. We all know about the mass incarceration problem, right? But for every person who's behind bars, at this point, it looks to me as if there are 10 people in society who have a felony in their background. I say it looks like because our government does not collect information on this. This is
Seems like a
not
common theme
so
here.
There is some work that's been done by some pioneering work by a team of demographers that I refer to in my book. There's a little bit of other work, but probably one in seven adult men in the United States today has a felony conviction in his background, and it's probably a little higher, a little worse than one in seven for prime age men. There is only a tiny bit of information on the employment patterns of ex-cons in America today, or even people who have been sentenced to a felony and haven't gone to prison for it. But it's exactly what you would think. They do materially worse, from what we can see, materially worse in the job market than high school dropouts, who are the kind of like the lowest rung in general. And we might be able to do a lot more about what's called reentry if we had, evidence-based policies on reentry. I mean, especially now that we've got this labor shortage, right? But you can't have evidence-based policies if you don't have the evidence. And I think that it is absolutely unjustifiable that we have this kind, that we have cast these tens of millions of American citizens into this statistical invisibility.
Oh, okay. And tens of millions, that's sort of what you...
25 million, okay. Let's say. 25.
All right. Again, that's I'm sure there's a lot we could dig into in just that topic alone, but we have to start wrapping this up. So we are creating, you know, what I would consider these sort of dangerously dependent or just checked out, you know, chronically not being put to productive use populations now. You've done a good job of explaining why that is not something that we should be aspiring to from an individual or a societal perspective. So I make you emperor, Nicholas, here, right? What reforms would you most want to enact to try to combat this?
Well, if you could make me God, I would fix the family, and I would reinstill faith and beliefs to a circa 1965 level in the United States. But I don't think even the king can do that. So let's put that off in its own box, okay? To begin with, I think we'd want to encourage people who are not part of government, outside of government, in civil society, to commit truth in public and to commit truth around the dinner table and to say what we all know about the importance of work, yes, for money, but not just for money in our society. Not everybody can work, but if people can work and they want to work, they should be encouraged to do so. And it's going to be good for them as well. So that's a sort of a civil society thing. And that also is connected to the kind of reintroduction of summer jobs for young people, which I think will have a very positive long-term impact on our society if we can encourage that more. That's not something that I would want Uncle Sam to do. There are always unintended consequences to Uncle's interventions, but it's something that the rest of us might, you know, want to do our own little bits where we can. As far as government goes, there are three things that I can think of, and I've kind of mentioned a couple of them already, but let's put them all together. The first, of course, would be more skills, imparting more skills on our young people and on our working age population. It's a kind of a ongoing scandal that our public K through 12 school system is so desperately spotty about graduating people who have skills. And it's also, I think, a bit of a self-condemnation that the educational establishment has omerted the word vocational. It's no longer politically correct to say vocational. I mean, so okay, yeah. You look in the mirror and you think everybody should go to college. They should be like you. College isn't for everybody, but everybody should graduate with a skill of some sort that you can support yourself with. So there's obviously a big gap there. A reform of our broken, dysfunctional disability archipelago along the lines of the welfare reform that we had back in the 90s. I realized back in the 90s, Democrats and Republicans could play nice together and get things done bipartisan. And, that doesn't seem to be so easy nowadays. But a reform of our wealth, of our disability system to a work first principle, I think would be a change that would, it would create some problems, I imagine, but the problems would be replacing bigger problems with smaller problems if we could do this. It's easier said than done, but I think it's worth trying. And then there's that enormous invisible population of ex-cons in America. I mean, they shouldn't be just they've paid their debt to society. this is the population that's been sentenced and is out, right? Some of them will be recidivists, but many of them will want to reintegrate into families, into society, into the labor force if we will let them. And now that we've got this screaming labor shortage, you'd think that this would be an excellent time for that. I realize it's a little bit more difficult salesmanship with crime rates going up at this point than it would have been during the previous generation, but I think there's something there that could be win-win for millions and millions.
All right, those all make total sense. I'm curious, and I'm just spitballing here. And look, I'm generally not a fan of government programs, but sometimes they can provide the onboard that then private industry takes the ball up later on. What do you think about sort of like a mandatory national service, like a lot of countries have, right? Which would either be, 2 years in the military where you're learning specific skills there, or like an AmeriCorps type of thing, right? And so much of at least the current administration is, putting trillions out there for, massive green projects. They're gonna, rebuild the energy grid and stuff like that. It's gonna need a lot of labor. What are you thinking about that, where we basically say, hey, for at least 2 years of your life, you commit to improving society, and we're going to make sure in those 2 years you're going to learn something that's going to be marketable coming out of there.
If we weren't so horribly politicized at the moment, I'd be a little bit less worried about the unintended consequences of
Okay.
this sort of an initiative.
Let me ask
But
you this. In the scenario where you're emperor, do you do this? So you get to control the politics.
well, if I get to control the politics, we're getting awfully totalitarian there, and I don't like the totalitarian part of it. If we had a different world, yes, maybe this could be a good program for a different world. But the part that I'm concerned about is that unless we have a big change in our government and a big change in our culture. I mean, remember, part of what we have seen over our lifetimes has been the death of truth in the public square. So indoctrination, whether it's corporate indoctrination or government indoctrination or indoctrination in schools, can proceed a lot more shamelessly than it would have in the past. If I could cure the death of truth in the public square, with my imperial wand, then I'd feel a lot better about the prospect of a national public service commitment.
Okay, so let me just restate this. I would say that if it could be prevented from turning into a madrasa of some
political correctness Madras.
Of some ideology that whatever the administration that was in charge was pushing, you would be in favor of something like
that. I think it could have some, I think it would certainly be worth experimenting with. I don't know that it would be the final place that we'd go, but if we had experiments, we can learn from experiments.
Okay, great. All right. Well, look, this has been an absolutely fascinating conversation, Nicholas, and just a critically important topic. You call it in your book, The Invisible Crisis. I think we'll first thank you for trying to get it into the light and make it a little bit more visible here. And as I said earlier, I hope other social scientists and then other, political ones get involved to start saying, hey, look, this is a real problem and we need to actually start doing something about it, because for all the reasons you and I have talked about, the more that this builds momentum and the current trajectory it's on, the worse our longer term prospects for a nation are going to be. And of course, the more people fall into this state that's not one for the individual to aspire to be in. For folks that have really enjoyed getting to know you through this conversation and your work, where can they go to follow you and your efforts going forward?
Well, first, Adam, let me thank you for making your commitment just now to putting a spotlight on this problem. This helps. I think this helps. So thank you for that. You can find my homework if you Google Nicholas Eberstadt, American Enterprise Institute. You will see that I have a scholars page at the American Enterprise Institute. Strangely enough, I also have a copy of this book here, Men Without Work, a post-pandemic edition. You can also Google the book and purchase it through your favorite online source for purchasing books, or through the Templeton Press, who put it out. But I think that's probably the easiest way to find out any of the stuff that I'm doing.
Okay, great. I'm glad you put the book up on the screen. Folks, go get that. And we'll put Google and spell your name there on the screen with an overlay when we edit this, so people know exactly what to go Google for there. Be there. All right. Well, Nicholas, I can't thank you enough. Folks, if you're watching and have enjoyed this conversation with Nicholas and would like to see both him return to the program for us to dig even further into some of the topics we could only cursorily address here, as well as other great minds like him, do us a favor, support this channel by hitting the like button and then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Nicholas, I just want to thank you so much again. This has been a really valuable conversation.
Adam, it was a pleasure for me. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you. And everybody else, thanks so much for watching.